In this interview, Ed speaks with Debbie Epstein about diversity in the law firm, with specific focus on gender issues. Debbie is the founder and principal of FlexTime Lawyers LLC, who helps law firms address gender issues, specifically how to retain women in their ranks. Women in many of the top-ranked law schools comprise more than 50% of the graduating classes, and have for quite a few years. Yet, this percentage is not reflected as law firm partners, management, or committee members. What is the reason for this, and why is it important?
Debbie, thanks for joining us today. I look forward to our conversation about a topic that really is becoming more and more important to both genders in this field of practice of law, as well as in the country.
Thank you, Ed. I'm delighted to be here.
You are the founder and president of FlexTime Lawyers, LLC. Tell us a little bit first what it is that your company does.
Sure. We're a national networking and consulting firm advising lawyers and legal employers on work-life balance and women's issues. I founded FlexTime Lawyers in 1999, largely as a chapter organization advising individual lawyers on work-life balance strategies. And the chapter organization expanded into a networking and consulting firm, and now I work with employers with strategies on retaining and promoting women in the legal profession, revamping flex time and part-time policies, and doing strategic development on women's initiatives.
There's a lot in what you just said, and I want to start our conversation perhaps about the work-life balance debate. It seems to me that that's almost a misnomer, and it never has been the appropriate terminology. I'm not sure what the right terminology is, but I'm old enough to know and remember that people who wanted to get ahead, people who wanted to own and run their own businesses and just rather type A assertive personalities always worked very hard. And I'm not sure that there was such a thing. We didn't call it then work-life balance. We just called it, it's a hard life, it's hard work. What's the difference today?
Well, one of the differences is the sheer number of hours that are expected in a daily lawyer's life. In 1965, the ABA reported that lawyers on average billed 1,200 to 1,600 hours a year. Now the numbers climb to, on average, 2,000 to 2,200 hours, and at many of the large law firms nationally, they can escalate to 2,500 to 3,000 hours. So just as a starting point, the numbers of hours and the expectation of responsiveness and accessibility, largely due to technology, has really changed the way in which we practice law, and that's one really significant issue. The other interesting point is that outside of practicing law, life demands have become even more acute as well. For example, demands in the community, demands in parenting have become particularly accentuated as well. So you've got these two competing interests and technology interfering in some respects, making life significantly easier in some ways, but also bringing about many more challenges because there's an expectation that you're available 24/7. And these various converging factors have really made life more challenging for all practicing lawyers, not just working mothers who were the sort of initiators of the work-life discussion.
Well, I remember in the early part of my career where working 100 to 120 hours a week was not all that unusual. And perhaps what's happening today in the legal community is merely catching up with what has been going on in industry for many years. Is that possible?
That is possible, but you know, another significant variable in this discussion is the demographic that is now graduating law schools, and that's the Generation Y individuals. And Gen Y law students and young lawyers are saying we also don't want to live life and practice law the way the traditionalists did or the baby boomers did, for that matter. They're saying we value things other than money and advancement, and we are more family-centric, and we are committed often to other causes outside of work, and we don't want to practice law in that way. And this is the largest employee and consumer group thus far. And with Gen Y individuals making these other needs known, they're really changing the complexion of the discussion.
Well, I think your point is right on. It was interesting. I had a conversation with a group of managing partners just this very morning, and one of the observations that was made on this topic is that today's crop of young people have never really lived through hard times, and as a consequence, they're able to see choices that perhaps their parents didn't see and the previous generation didn't see. And when you move beyond the survival stage, you begin to have other options. And maybe that's what's happening today with today's younger lawyers. Of course, I'm not sure that the buyers of legal services, the corporate 1000 and the like, are of the same mind. but I think from the perspective of the younger lawyers, you're right on target.
Right, and I think there is, of course, always the client concern, but really the statistics are very compelling. MIT came out with a study earlier this year, and they found that of lawyers who left law firms, 60% of women and 40% of men cited difficulty integrating work and family and personal life as a significant reason for leaving their law firms. And so that is part of the changing discussion, too. It's not just these younger lawyers, but it's men as well as women at all different stages of their career. Another interesting point of consideration is just the attrition rates at law firms nationally and how rates indicate that there's a problem with the model in place. NALP Foundation did a study that came out in 2005 finding that 78% of female and male associates leave their law firms within 5 years. And even though many law firms rely on the attrition model, that's part of their model for success, they still want to have control over which lawyers are leaving, and they don't want their talented lawyers to be walking out the door. So there are just a number of factors attributable to work-life concerns that really should make all law firms pause and think, are there things we could be doing better?
I agree with you, and I think one of the changes in the demographic is highlighted in my own family, where the young man, the new father, is as much involved in the rearing of the child as is the mother. And that did not happen in earlier days. The man was perceived to be the breadwinner, the mother was the caregiver, and there was seldom a mixing of the two roles. In today's world, I know I have a son and a son-in-law that are raising their children as much as their spouses are, and that didn't happen before.
Right. And the other thing that is an interesting complement to it is just looking at the composition of law school graduating classes, and they're approximately 50% women, and so that if you look at those numbers and think about those numbers across professions, we have women equally present in comparable professions and making those demands on their spouses in terms of contribution at home as well as at work.
Well, let me ask you this question, since you raised that statistic. For many years, there have been more and more and more women graduating from law school. About a generation and a half ago when I graduated, or an era ago, whatever, there were a considerable number of women, but not the predominance. In today's world, more than 50%, as far as the statistics that I've seen, show that women are graduating from the law school, and we're beginning now to see here and there women becoming managing partners of the law firm. So they're really moving up in the ranks, maybe not as fast as some would like, but nevertheless they're moving up. But a countervailing statistic is that of the people who are leaving the practice, not just the law firm, but actually leaving the practice, the larger number are female. And how does this, what does this portend for the future of the law firm, the balance of needs and skills in a law firm, if though you're graduating more women, you're also losing more women from the ranks?
Well, I'd like to respond in a number of ways to that question. First, it's really important when we think about women leaving law firms to track where they're going, and the best research along those lines is this May 2007 MIT report that came out that really looked not only at the women who left, but said, where are they going? Are they going to be stay-at-home moms? Are they going to government, not-for-profit, or in-house legal departments? Are they going to continue to work but in other industries? So it's really important to look where they're going, because if they're continuing to work, then really the question comes back to the legal profession and whether it's an environment that women can thrive in and whether there are changes that should be made within the legal profession to retain and promote top talent and not lose them to other industries or other employers. But along the lines of losing women to become stay-at-home moms, that is a real statistic. The Center for Work-Life Policy came out with a report in the Harvard Business Review in March 2005 that found that 43% of women lawyers leave the profession independent of maternity leave at some point in their careers, and they leave the profession for, on average, 3 years. That, to me, is a very compelling statistic because it shows that nearly half of women lawyers work a non-traditional career trajectory and have a non-traditional career trajectory. And what that indicates to me is, once again, the current model is not one that's working. If you have nearly half of the lawyers entering the profession as women and nearly half of those women don't work conventionally, then we have to really redefine what conventional work is, and we need to look at the profession and say, are we maximizing our talent? And my answer to that question is no, and that's why the focus of my work is on working with employers to maximize the talent. And this isn't about accommodation in my mind. This is about understanding an employer's financial interest to retain and promote and work with female talent.
Well, I'm not sure it's just female talent, because if the reports are true that I'm getting, we see a number of men who are acting very much like the women that we're talking about, meaning that they would like to bill fewer hours, they would like some flex time, they'd like time to be with their family, they'd like time to devote to creative pursuits or other pursuits, as well as the women in our discussion.
That's absolutely right, and that points directly back to our earlier conversation about why, in my mind, the picture really has to change, because the statistics are compelling for both men and women. That being said, I do want to clarify that the issues and statistics for women are more acute, and that's why I highlight women in that respect. And the best example of that is looking at the path of women in law school versus women in partnership. Women have comprised, as we've discussed, 40-50% of law school graduating classes for over 20 years, yet women are still only approximately 17% of law firm partners nationally. And the question is, well, what is that disconnect and why has that taken place? And the explanation for women not being in the partnership ranks has largely been, oh, well, it's a pipeline issue, but 20 years of comprising over 40% of graduating classes in law school eradicates that.
One would think that they'd be in the pipeline after that long a period of time.
Long enough, exactly.
Right.
And so there has to be another explanation, and that other explanation is there are other issues at play here that are limiting women's opportunities for success and the challenges for retaining and promoting women lawyers, those challenges are more acute for women.
What are some of those other challenges?
I think there are really sort of five areas where women are having more challenges than men, and this is based on a guide I released in 2006 with the New York City Bar Association called the Cheat Sheet. And what we did in the Cheat Sheet is really broke down these different areas where women historically have stalled. Those areas, in addition to what we've been talking about, workplace flexibility and work-life balance, in addition to that point, mentoring, leadership, business development and networking, and partnership and advancement. Those are the other areas where I see women having more challenges than men and not historically doing thriving in the same capacity.
Well, for the purposes of our conversation here today, I suspect it's too limiting to be able to uncover why it is that they're having a different or greater challenges than the men in each of the areas that you mentioned. But I want to ask you, going back to the issue on flexibility or flex time, something that relates to a conversation that I had where the law firm was, in order to retain the lawyers, was willing to entertain flex time and, in fact, had a flex time program tailored to each person's need. And whether it was 90% or 80% of time, or in one case it actually was 65% of the time, and they still engaged the lawyer. In the cases under discussion, the lawyers were women. But I think the concept would apply to both genders. But the issue that was really interesting from the managing partner's perspective was that if you reduce the amount of time, in most cases, the lawyer who was going to benefit from the reduction in time was either unwilling to reduce their compensation or was prepared to reduce their compensation only with respect to the same degree that the time was going to be reduced, giving the law firm no credit for the reality that the law firm had to maintain an overhead or infrastructure that supported the lawyer, even a part-time lawyer, to the same extent as a full-time lawyer.
I just completed my first national law firm survey with Working Mother magazine called the Best Law Firms for Women Initiative, where we track trends nationally on work-life and women's issues, and it's standard across the country for law firms who allow reduced hours to also have the lawyers, let's say, choose a percentage, typically 60 to 80% of what full-time lawyers will bill, and typically they do have a proportionate reduction in pay that would match their reduced required billable hour number. And so that's standard. And I would strongly recommend that firms don't take an additional percentage penalty. To answer your question of why, overhead costs is one of the questions I repeatedly get from law firms about reasons why they don't want to either allow reduced hours or pay commensurate with the billable hours that the lawyer is billing. And what I say is really I would encourage you to look at the actual numbers and accurately assess what the accounting costs are. Most firms will just take the general overhead of the office, divide it by the number of lawyers, and say each lawyer expends this amount of money in overhead a year, which is really inaccurate. Because the lawyer, the law firm partner in the corner office is expending many more resources than the third-year associate telecommuting 2 days a week. So it's really important to apportion costs appropriately. And the two biggest costs that law firms assess are office space and insurance, malpractice insurance. And the former managing partner of Arnold & Porter wrote an article reporting on these numbers from a little while back, actually 2001. And when you look at these numbers in comparison to revenue generating of the lawyers working reduced hours, the incremental cost of overhead is so minimal that it really just dispenses with this argument. The other important number to consider when you look at your overhead costs in addition to revenues is to look at the costs of attrition. Most law firms will say, well, it's more profitable to have a lawyer billing 100% than 80%. And I say to these law firms, you're looking at the wrong economic equation. The proper economic equation is this lawyer talented and one we want to retain and promote, and we'd rather have him or her at 80% than not at all, because that is really the reality that they'll otherwise leave. And when you look at the attrition numbers for these lawyers, it costs a law firm, by conservative estimates, up to $500,000 to lose a second-year associate. And you think, really, are these the type of economic decisions we really should be making?
Well, it's interesting you talk about the cost of losing an associate. That's a factor that I've thought about and discussed for a number of years. And you talk about $500,000. The number that's been floated in my discussions has been between $200,000 and $400,000. Whatever the number is, it's clearly going up as salaries and compensation increases. So what may have been $250,000, $300,000, even $400,000, you know, 2 years ago, today probably is very close to the $500,000 mark. The thing that baffles me is that large law firms are prepared to accept that cost. And one managing partner said to me, well, that's just the culling process. And I'm thinking to myself, you may think of it as a culling process, but when you let go, let's say, 20 people, and the $500,000, that's what, $10 million, $5 million? And that goes right to the bottom line.
Exactly.
And that could go into the partner's pocket without any dilution. And you're treating this expense and this process so cavalierly that it baffles me.
Right, and that my statistic earlier is from the Project for Attorney Retention, and as I said, they attributed up to $500,000 for second-year associate. What I found fascinating about that statistic is, as you know, second-year associates are not even profitable. So to think it's caused that much potentially to lose somebody who's not even profitable, you can imagine how prohibitive it is when you're talking about fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth years who are running cases or deals. But there are other factors that firms need to consider. It's not just their own individual culling process, as this one lawyer put it to you. There are other people who are impacting this decision. One is in-house counsel. Increasingly, women are going in-house because of the perception that there's better work-life balance, and they want the lawyers who represent them to look more like them. But independent of women, as you know, increasingly diversity is being used as a criteria for selecting outside counsel, and it's not in the RFPs that are being sent out by in-house legal departments. They're asking, who are your women, who are your people of color, and are they running our cases and deals, or are they just at the lower levels? And as we've talked about as well, it's not just in-house legal departments, it's law students. And no law firm can afford to operate without half of the intellectual brain power of the profession and just eliminate that population in deciding, how they're going to run a law firm.
Well, Debbie, I want to thank you for joining us today and illuminating a really important issue not only for the society in general, but in particular for law firms and how they deal in the changing environment of our world. Thank you again.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.